Beneath the lush robe he wore a bathing suit in anticipation of the warm canals and pools beneath the palace. He would rather be there, playing splash tag with his concubines. As he passed a cluster of noblemen, he sighed. "What has my cousin done now? What does House Atreides have against a minor jungle world?" The emperor stopped, stiff-backed and imperial, while his flustered chamberlain summarized the bold military attack on Baikal, while a crowd of curious courtiers pressed closer. "I believe the Duke did the right thing," said a dignified man with graying hair, Lord Bane O'Garry of Hagal. "I find it disgusting that the Prime Magistrate could allow the Tleilaxu to desecrate a memorial honoring slain heroes." Shaddam was about to cast a withering glare on the Hagal lord when he noted murmurs of support among the other noblemen. He had underestimated the general antipathy toward the Tleilaxu, and these people were quietly cheering Leto for his boldness. "Why don't they ever cheer me when I take harsh, necessary actions?" Another nobleman interjected. "Duke Leto has the right to respond to such an insult. It was a matter of honor." Shaddam could not remember the man's name, or even his house. "And it was a matter of imperial law," Shaddam's wife, Anirul, interrupted, gliding between her husband and Chamberlain Redondo. Since the recent death of truth-sayer Lobia, Anirul had fluttered around Shaddam, as if she actually wanted to be at his side during every state function. "A man has the moral right to protect his family. Does that not include ancestors as well?" Some of the nobles nodded, and one man chuckled, as if Anirul had been witty. Shaddam sensed the winds of opinion. "Agreed," he said, strengthening the paternal tone in his voice. He considered how best to use this precedent for his purposes. "Baikal's underhanded arrangement with the Bene Tleilaxu was clearly illegal. I wish my dear cousin Leto had gone through proper channels, but I can understand his brash actions. He is still young." In his private thoughts, Shaddam was quick to realize how this Atreides military action could increase Leto's standing among the great houses. They saw the Duke as a man who dared to do what others would have been afraid to consider. Such popularity could be dangerous to the Golden Lion throne. He raised a ringed hand. "We will investigate this matter and issue our official opinion in due course." Leto's actions also opened the door for Shaddam's own upcoming plans. These gathered nobles respected a swift, unwavering demonstration of justice. An intriguing precedent, indeed. Anirul looked at her husband, sensing his shifting thoughts. She gave him a questioning glance, which he ignored. His smile seemed to disturb her greatly. His wife and her Bene Gesserit cronies kept too many secrets from him already, and he had every right to reciprocate. He would call his supreme bashar and set his own plans in motion. The old veteran, Zumgaron, would know exactly how to deal with the matter, and he would appreciate a chance to show the prowess of his Sardaukar in more than just a military parade. After all, the planet Zanavar, where the bastard Tyros Repha lived, was not so very different from Baikal. In the privacy of her own apartments, Lady Anirul's sensory pen created scratchy hieroglyphics in the air. A potted tropical plant with jet-black flowers stood beside her, exuding electric scents. Above the desktop, Anirul's sensory conceptual journal hovered as she wrote upon paperless pages, recording her innermost thoughts, things her husband must never discover. She scribbled, in the impenetrable code language of the Bene Gesserit, the long-forgotten tongue used in the ancient Ajar book. She wrote of her sadness at the passing of truth-sayer Lobia, of the affection she had felt toward the old woman. Oh, wouldn't Mother Superior Harishka raise her eyebrows at such a naked confession of emotion? But Annie Rule missed her friend terribly. She had no other close companions in the imperial court, only insufferable sycophants who sought her favor to increase their own standing. Lobbia had been different, though. Annie Rule now held the old woman's memory and experiences inside of her, among the cacophony of hundreds of past generations, a forest of lives too thick to explore. "I miss you, old friend." With some embarrassment, Annie Rule caught herself. She touched a button on the sensory pen, watched both instrument and journal disappear like a wisp of fog into her pale blue soustone ring. Annie Rule performed a series of breathing exercises. The background sounds of the palace diminished, and she heard only her inner voice whispering, "Mother Lobbia, can you hear me? Are you there?" Other memory could be unsettling at times, as if her ancestors were spying upon her from within her own skull. Though she disliked this loss of basic human privacy, usually she found their presence comforting. The conglomeration of lives formed a library within, on the intermittent occasions when she could access it, a reservoir of wisdom and encouragement. Lobbia was in there somewhere, lost among countless ghosts, just waiting to speak out. Determined, Annie Rule closed her eyes and vowed to find the truth-sayer, to plunge into the clamor until she located Lobbia. She went down, down, deeper. It was like an eggshell-thin dam waiting to be broken. She had never attempted such a radical excavation of the past within, knowing that she risked becoming irretrievably lost in the nether realm of voices. But Annie Rule was the Kwisatz mother, chosen for the secret position because she had more access to the genetic past than any living sister. Nonetheless, this was not a journey one should risk without the support and safety net of other sisters. She felt a stirring, an eddy in the flow of other memory. "Lobbia," she called out with her mind. The turmoil intensified, as if she were approaching a room full of noisy people. She perceived veils of swirling color in hues she had never imagined possible, filmy screens that would not permit her to enter. "Lobbia, where are you?" But instead of producing a response from a solitary voice, her agitation swelled the voices into a howling mob, screaming out warnings of disaster. It terrified her, and she had no choice but to flee. Annie Rule awoke to find herself in her study again, seeing her surroundings through blurred vision. A portion of her felt as if it had remained behind, trapped deep within the collective intellect of the Bene Gesserit. She did not move a muscle as she flowed away from other memory, leaving their fearsome admonitions behind. Gradually, she felt her skin tingling. When, at last, she could move, her vision cleared. The voices within sensed that something terrible and unpreventable was about to happen. Something to do with the long-awaited Kwisatz Haderach, who was only one generation away. The seed was already growing inside the womb of the unsuspecting Jessica. Other memory warned of disaster. Annie Rule would rather see the Imperium itself fall before any harm came to that child. In the privacy of her spacious chambers, the Kwisatz mother drank spice tea and spoke in coded whispers to Reverend Mother Mohiam. Mohiam narrowed her bird-like eyes. "Are you certain of the vision you experienced? Duke Leto Atreides is not likely to let Jessica go. Shall I journey to Caladan to protect her? His brash attack on Beakal may have left him vulnerable to retaliation from his enemies, and Jessica might become a target. Is this what you have seen?" "Nothing is certain in other memory, not even for the Kwisatz mother. Anirul took a long, sweet sip, then set down her cup. "But you must not leave, Mohiyam. You are to stay here in the palace." Her expression became hard. "I have received word from Wallach Nine. Mother Superior Harishka has chosen you to replace Lobia as the Emperor's truth-sayer." If Mohiyam was surprised or delighted, she let neither emotion show. Instead, she concentrated on the matter at hand. "Then how are we to keep Jessica and the baby safe?" "I have decided that we must bring this young woman here to Kaitain for the remainder of her pregnancy. That is how we will solve the problem." Mohiyam brightened. "An excellent suggestion. We can monitor every step of the pregnancy." She smiled ironically. "Duke Leto will not like it, though." "A man's wishes do not enter into this matter." Anirul sank back in her chair, heard the crinkle of the chair's velvet-padded cushion. She felt enormously weary. "Jessica will give birth to her daughter here, in the Imperial Palace." Stabilizing the present is assumed to be a form of balance. But inevitably, this action turns out to be dangerous. Law and order are deadly. Trying to control the future serves only to deform it. Carbon Fether, The Folly of Imperial Politics. Spending a day in the crowded amusement palace on Zanovar, the docent Glax Othon had never felt so old, or so young. Dressed in a casual single suit of pale green twill cloth, he felt himself gradually begin to relax, forgetting about the mysterious threat to his ward, Tyros Repha. He laughed with the squealing children and ate sweet confections. He played games that purportedly tested his skill, though he knew the Barkers always stacked the odds in their favor. He didn't care, though it would have been nice to bring a prize back home just as a memento. The colors and smells of this place whirled around him like a ballet for the masses, and Othon smiled. Repha had known exactly what the old teacher needed. He hoped the young man, who was even now on the main Taligari planet, would enjoy the suspenser opera as much as Othon was enjoying this unusual outing. The day was long and exhausting, but stimulating. Left to his own devices, Othon would never have permitted himself such an unabashedly amusing vacation. His longtime student had taught him a valuable lesson. Wiping sweat-dampened gray hair from his eyes, Othon looked up just as a shadow crossed the sun. Around him, the music and laughter continued. Someone screamed. He turned to see a daredevil float disc whisk overhead in free-form fashion, looping obstacles that stretched high into the air. The passengers held on, shrieking with mock terror. Then more shadows darkened the sky, large and ominous. At first, the docent did not imagine that the huge ships could be anything other than a part of the wild show. Inside the crowded amusement park, people waited in lines for sensory enhancement rides, mazes, holodances. Others tried their luck at food vendor stands, where treats could be purchased for an amusing tale or a song. Many of the people looked up. Munching the last of his crystal fruit confection, the docent watched with curiosity instead of fear, until the first weapons began to fire. In the vanguard ship, Shaddam's commanding general, Supreme Bashar Garon, directed the devastating strike himself. It was his sworn duty to fire the first shot, to mark the first casualties, to draw the first blood. An armored ornithopter swooped over the park's towering sandworm centerpiece, an articulated construction surrounded by false dunes. Explosions tore the air. Weapons fire peppered the ground. Sparks accompanied flames and smoke as diaphanous structures collapsed, People screamed and ran. The docent's stentorian voice, made powerful by years of lecturing in halls packed with restless students, roared across the growing noise. "Shelter! Find cover!" But there was no place to hide. Are they doing this to find Tyros Refa? The Supreme Bashar's Sardaukar Death Squad wore gray and black uniforms. Targeting with steely eyes, sallow-skinned Garon strafed children, melting them into unrecognizable fused forms. It was only the beginning. After the first shot scattered the crowds and wreaked havoc, the squadron fired on the sandworm simulacrum. Then they used cutter beams to dismantle the gaudy centerpiece into chunks of smoking metal wreckage, exposing the thick-walled melange vaults buried underneath. In accordance with Imperial orders, the advance troops had to find and retrieve the illegal spice stockpile. Afterward, the destruction of the main cities on Zanavar could proceed. Garon set his thopter down atop a pile of crisped human remains, and his soldiers streamed out, firing at anything that moved. The unarmed patrons of the amusement park ran in confusion and terror. More Imperial gunships set down on the park grounds, disgorging soldiers who streamed into the ruins of the giant sandworm structure. The simulacrum had ostensibly been a simple amusement park attraction that towered 100 meters over the landscape, but the giant monument concealed underground tunnels filled with melange. In the midst of the carnage, only one man dared approach the soldiers through the smoke and bodies, an old teacher. His face was devastated but stern, like a schoolmaster about to discipline unruly students. Zoom Garon recognized the docent Glaxauthan from his pre-mission military briefing. Blood soaked Authan's shoulder, and the gray hair had been singed off the left side of his head. He seemed to feel no pain, only appalled anger. So much bloodshed, just to hurt Tyros. The docent, who had delivered many stirring speeches during his tenure, raised his voice. "This is unconscionable!" The Supreme Bashar, his uniform impeccably clean and unwrinkled, responded with a wry smile as knotted plumes of smoke streamed upward. Burned bodies twitched on the ground. And behind Othan, a palatial structure in the amusement complex collapsed with a groan and a bang. "Teacher, you must learn the difference between theory and practice." At a hand signal from Garon, his Sardaukar cut down the docent before he could take another step. Dispassionately, the Supreme Bashar turned his attention back to the ruined sandworm structure to oversee the recovery operations. Surrounded by acrid fumes, he removed a private log recorder from his uniform pocket and dictated a report to Shaddam as he observed the carnage. Smoke and stench of the catastrophe. Bands of Sardaukar loaded the gunships with contraband spice. Like swollen bumblebees, the thopters lumbered into the skies toward waiting transport ships. The Emperor would deliver the confiscated melange as a reward to Choam and the Spacing Guild. With self-righteous confidence, he would declare this the opening salvo of his great spice war. The Supreme Bashar anticipated exciting times ahead. Operating on a tight timetable, Garon ordered his remaining ground troops to return to the large military vessels. Melange safely in hand, the rest of the annihilation could be accomplished from a distance. Garon would watch from his command chair without dirtying his hands. The squadron lifted off, oblivious to the moans of the injured, the screams of children. The heavy battleships moved into low orbit. From there, they would finish the job of leveling the city, and then they would target a certain nearby estate. In Refa's fern gardens, a hot breeze picked up, rippling the verdant fronds with a sound like fluttering feathers. Charence, the property administrator, switched off the fountain cascades as he walked up the slope. He had already commissioned gardeners and aquatic engineers to complete a full maintenance check of the fountain systems while his master was away on Talagari. Meticulous in his duties, Charence took great pride in knowing that Tyros Repha never even noticed the work he did on the estate. This was the best compliment an administrator could hope to receive. The gardens and household ran so smoothly that his master never had cause for complaint. The docent had assigned Charence to serve Tyros Repha from the moment the mysterious boy had arrived on Zanovar, more than 4 decades ago. The loyal servant had never asked questions about the boy's parentage or the source of his inexhaustible fortune. Charence, a focused man with plenty of responsibilities, had no time for curiosity. As the last trickles of water drained from the fountain cascade, he stood inside the flow tree gazebo atop a flagstoned knoll. Workers in overalls carried buckets and hoses as they marched toward piping substations carefully hidden in the mushroom gardens. Charence could hear them whistling and chattering in the clear air. He never noticed the warships overhead. The estate manager focused on the real world around him, rather than looking at the sky above. Lasgun blasts tore through the air like bolts, hurled by an angry thunder god. Sonic booms of ionized air flattened the trees. Parks and lakes crackled on the horizon, vaporized into a dead plain of glass. Eyes aching from the brilliant light, Charence looked up now, watching the myriad bolts of destruction intersect at Repha's estate. He stood frozen, unable even to flee. He faced the storm as a locomotive of hot wind howled toward him. Flames rolled across the landscape like red tsunamis, a stampede of white-hot incandescence that flashed the patchwork fields and forested areas into oblivion so quickly that even smoke didn't have a chance to rise. When the shock wave passed by, it left nothing of the beautiful gardens or buildings, not even rubble. In the shimmering city of Artesia, on the night side of the Talagari homeworld, Tyros Repha attended the glamorous Suspenser Opera alone. He sat in a private box, intent on understanding the nuances and complexities of the show, enthralled by the color and spectacle. All in all, he enjoyed it very much, and looked forward to sharing his experience with the docent when he got home to Zanovar. Following 2 generations of chaos, when mankind finally overcame the insidious control of machines, a new concept emerged. Man may not be replaced. Precepts of the Butlerian Jihad. From a balcony, Prince Romber peered down into the grand ballroom. The preparations continued with a relentless momentum. Servants, decorators, and caterers swarmed through Castle Caladan. It was like watching an army get ready for war. Though few of his original physical systems remained, Romber felt anxiety in the pit of his artificial stomach. He observed unobtrusively, because if he were seen, a dozen people would assault him with endless questions about 1,000 little decisions, and he had enough on his mind. He wore a white retro tuxedo that had been fitted to cover the synthetic skin and servo mechanisms that moved his replacement limbs. Despite his extensive scarring, Romber looked quite dashing. Exactly as a man should, on his wedding day. All across the gleaming floor below, servants bustled under the direction of the festival planner. An exquisitely attired off-world woman with a narrow, dark face that gave her a look of intriguing contrasts, like a Caladanian primitive vaulted into modern society. Her melodious voice cut through the clamor as she issued a steady stream of orders in formal Gaelic. Servants jumped to follow her commands, setting up baskets of blossoms and sprays of colored corals, arranging ritual articles on the altar for the ceremonial priest, cleaning up spills, straightening wrinkles. Overhead, In an unobtrusive clear-plaz enclosure between the beams of a curving, vaulted ceiling, a holoprojection crew set up and tested their equipment. Immense chandeliers of the purest balut crystal hung in tapered tiers, casting a golden glow over the congregational seating. An arrangement of exotic vine flowers climbed a pillar next to Romber's perch, imparting a sweet perfume of rare hibiscus violets. The aroma was a bit too strong, and with a slight twist of a control knob on a panel at his waist, he adjusted his olfactory sensor to diminish its sensitivity. At his insistence, the Caladan ballroom looked as if it had been transported intact from the Grand Palais of Ix. It reminded him of a time when House Vernius had headed the powerful industrial world, developing innovative technology, as it would again. As he stood on the high balcony, he became aware of the pumping action of his mechanical lungs, the rhythmic beating of his machine heart. He looked at the inorganic skin on his left hand, the intricate fingerprint whorls and the naked third finger, over which Tessia would soon slip a wedding ring. Many soldiers chose to marry their sweethearts before rushing off to war. Romber was about to lead the conquest of Ix and restore his family fortunes. How could he do any less than make Tessia his wife? He flexed the thick prosthetic digits, and they did as his mind commanded, but with an ever-so-slight stiffness. Recently he had experienced dramatic improvements in his fine motor control, but he felt a slight regression today, perhaps from the stress of the occasion. He hoped he didn't do anything humiliating during the ceremony. On a platform behind the altar, an orchestra practiced the processional from the Ixian Wedding Concerto, traditional music by which all Vernius noblemen had taken their marital vows. And the time-honored practice would continue, no matter how far his house had fallen from favor. The stirring music, with rhythmic, brassy sounds suggestive of large-scale industry, filled him with nostalgia and strength. Romber's sister Kylia had always fantasized about such a ceremony for herself. If only she could still be here. If only things had been different, and she'd made other choices. Had she truly been an evil person? Romber wrestled with the question every day, as he dealt with the after effects of her misguided treachery. Despite the lingering pain, he had made up his mind to forgive her. But it was a continuing struggle. Light flashed from above, projectors hummed, and a solido hollow form appeared in front of him. He caught his breath. It was an old animated image of his sister in a brocaded lavender dress and diamonds, when she was still a teenager, strikingly beautiful with shimmering copper-dark hair. The image flickered and seemed to come alive, a smile on the generous, cat-like mouth. From the grand ballroom floor, the wedding coordinator gazed toward the projection and spoke into a holocom transceiver at her neck. At the coordinator's command, the image of Kylia placed its hands on its hips, and the mouth moved. "What are you doing way up there? You can't hide from your own wedding. Get yourself into the dressing room for your boutonniere. Your hair looks must." The pretty hologram glided through open air toward the seating section, where her image would symbolically occupy one of the front row seats. Self-consciously, Romber touched his head, where manufactured hair covered the metal skullcap that protected his cranium. Chagrined, he waved to the wedding coordinator and hurried into an adjoining room, where manservants attended him. Shortly after the Ixian fanfare sounded in the ballroom, the wedding coordinator appeared in the doorway. "This way, please, Prince Romber." Showing no awareness or concern because of his artificial limbs, she extended a hand. With dignified steps, she led him to a flower-decked narthex. For the past hour, invited guests had streamed in, wearing fine clothes, pressing into the allocated seats. Uniformed members of the Atreides House Guard lined up against the stone walls, carrying purple and copper banners. The only conspicuous exceptions were Thufir Hawat and Gurney Halleck, who had not yet returned from their infiltration of Ix. At the altar, Duke Leto Atreides wore a formal green jacket with a ducal chain of office hanging from his neck. Though his eyes were somber and his face was seamed with tragedy, he brightened upon seeing Romber. Duncan Idaho stood as master of arms, proudly holding the old duke's sword, ready to lop off the head of anyone who objected to the marriage. Hollow relays glimmered across the ceiling, causing an image of Romber's father to appear beside the prince as soon as he stepped into the aisle. Directed by transmissions from the wedding coordinator, the holographic Dominic Vernius wore a huge grin under his broad mustache, and his bald pate shone. Momentarily overwhelmed by the sight, Romber swayed on his prosthetic feet and whispered, as if the hollow next to him could hear him, "I have waited long enough, Father, much too long, and I feel shame for it. My life was too comfortable before the accident that made me like this. I think differently now. Ironically, I am stronger and more decisive, better in many ways than I was before. For you, for the suffering people of Ix, and even for myself, I will retake our homeworld, or die in the effort." But the hollow image, if it contained any spirit of Dominic himself, did not show it. The grin remained, as if the Ixian patriarch had not a care in the universe on his son's wedding day. With a deep sigh of his mechanical lungs, Romber stepped forward into position. He was grateful to Tessia for encouraging him, for demanding that he become strong. But he no longer needed to be chided by her. As he recovered physically, reminded every day of the accident that nearly took his life, he felt more and more determined. The Tleilaxu would not get away with what they had done to his family, to his people. Catching the gaze of Duke Leto at the altar, Romber realized he must look too serious for such an occasion. So he smiled broadly, but not with the vacuous expression of the hollow Dominic beside him. Romber's smile was one of happiness tempered by a clear view of his place in history. This wedding day, this bond with an incredible Bene Gesserit woman, was a stepping stone. One day he and Tessia would occupy the Grand Palais of Ix as Earl and Lady. Many of the guests had also dressed in Ixian finery to join the famous holoforms filling the pews. Vivid reminders, both happy and sad. The former ambassador to Kaitain, Kamar Pilru, was there in the flesh, though his deceased wife, Satina, was present only in holoform. Their twin sons, Demur and Keter, looked exactly as they had when they were growing up on Ix. Romber remembered scents, sounds, expressions, voices. During rehearsal the day before, he had touched his father's hand, but had felt nothing, only static and projected electricity. If only it could be real. He heard a rustling behind him, and a whisper of indrawn breath from the audience. Turning, he saw Tessia gliding toward him from an arched alcove, with all the poise of a high-ranking Bene Gesserit. Vibrant and smiling, she looked like an angel in a long gown of pearlescent mare silk, her head bowed behind an exquisite lace veil. Normally rather plain-looking, with sepia eyes and mousy brown hair, Tessia summoned an aura of self-assurance and grace today that made her thrum with an inner beauty. Everyone in the audience seemed to see in her what Romber had known and loved all along. An image of Lady Shando Vernius walked beside the bride. Romber had not seen his mother since they'd been separated during the frantic, bloody Tleilaxu takeover of Ix. She had always expected so much from her son. Now the four of them came together in the center aisle, the hollow projections of Dominic and Shando on the outside, Romber and Tesha at the center. Behind them strutted the ceremonial priest, carrying a thick, bound copy of the Orange Catholic Bible. The crowd fell into a hush. The house guards stood at attention, holding the Ixion banner high overhead. Duncan Idaho grinned, then took on a more serious expression. Trumpets blared, and the Ixion wedding concerto resounded through the ballroom. The bride, groom, and entourage proceeded down the purple-carpeted aisle. Romber marched with a flawless mechanical stride, his chest puffed out in the manner of a proud nobleman. Though space for the general audience was limited, images of the scene were transmitted across the planet, capturing every moment. The people of Caladan had always loved a spectacle. Romber concentrated on moving his legs to propel himself along the purple carpet ahead of him, and on the loveliness of Tesha. In the front row sat Jessica, casting occasional glances at Leto, who stood near the altar. She focused on him and narrowed her eyes, trying to determine what he was feeling. Even with her Bene Gesserit powers of observation, she had trouble penetrating Leto's closely held thoughts. Where had he learned to do that? From his father, undoubtedly. Though he was 2 decades in his grave, the old Duke still exercised great influence over his son. Reaching the altar, Romber and Tesha moved apart, allowing the priest to pass between them. They then stepped together behind him, leaving the hollow forms of Dominic and Shando next to Leto, who served as best man. The wedding music ended, and the ballroom fell into an anticipatory silence. From a golden table on the altar, the priest took 2 jewel-studded candlesticks and lifted them high in the air. After the priest touched a hidden censer, a pair of candles extruded from each base and burst into flames of different hues, one purple and the other copper. As he recited the wedding invocation, he handed 1 set of candles to Romber and 1 to Tesha. "We are gathered here to celebrate the union of Prince Romber Vernius of Ix and Sister Tesha Yasko of the Bene Gesserit." Flipping through the thick, hand-lettered Orange Catholic Bible on its pedestal in front of him, he read a number of passages, some of which had been suggested by Gurney Halleck. Romber and Tesha turned and extended their candles toward each other. The colored flames merged to become an entwined fire of purple and copper. He lifted Tesha's veil to reveal her radiant, intelligent face, filled with compassion and love. Her brown hair shone with dark luster, and her wide-set eyes sparkled. Seeing his bride, he ached for her, could not believe that she had stayed with him. Romber felt the sting of imaginary tears his damaged body was no longer capable of producing. Leto stepped forward, holding the rings on a crystal tray. Without breaking their loving gazes, the prince and his bride placed wedding rings on each other's fingers. "It has been a long, hard road," he said in his synthesized voice, "for us and for all of my people. I will always walk beside you, my prince." The triumphant, energetic recessional from the wedding concerto began, and the couple made their way back down the aisle, with Tesha's arm wrapped in Romber's. Leaning close, she smiled. "That wasn't so difficult, was it?" "My artificial body is able to withstand even the most grueling of tortures." Tesha's throaty laugh caused several members of the audience to chuckle with her, and to wonder what her whispered response was afterward. The Ixion couple and their invited guests banqueted and danced far into the evening. On such a day, Romber began to believe in fresh possibilities. But they still had heard no word from Gurney Halleck and Thufir Hawat. On the morning after the wedding, Jessica received a message cylinder bearing the scarlet and gold seal of House Corino. A curious Leto stood beside her, rubbing his red eyes. Jessica had not counted the number of glasses of Caladan wine he had consumed the night before. "It's not often that my concubine receives a communique from the Imperial Court." She cut through the seal with a fingernail and removed an Imperial scroll. Written on Carino parchment, the message was in a Bene Gesserit cipher. Jessica tried not to show her surprise as she translated the words and relayed them to Leto. "My Duke, it is a formal summons from Lady Anirul Carino for me to come to the Imperial Court on Kaitain. She says she is in need of a new lady-in-waiting, and..." She caught her breath as she read. "My old teacher Mohiam has been appointed the Emperor's new truth-sayer. She recommended me to Lady Anirul, and she has accepted." "Without asking me?" Leto said, anger mounting. "That seems odd and capricious." "I am subject to the commands of the Sisterhood, my Duke. You have always known this." He scowled, surprised at himself. Because he had initially been so resistant when the black-robed women had first tried to force young Jessica upon him. "I still don't like it." "The Emperor's wife suggests that I make plans to remain there for the duration of my pregnancy." Her oval face showed surprise and bafflement. Leto took the scroll and looked at it himself, but could not read the strange symbols. "I don't understand. Have you ever even met Anirul? Why would she want you to have our baby at the palace? Is Shaddam trying to take an Atreides hostage?" Jessica reread the scroll, as if the answers might be hidden there. "Truly, my Duke, I do not understand." Leto was not pleased with the summons, and felt especially troubled by a situation he could not control or understand. "Do they expect me to abandon all my duties here and just move to Kaitain with you? I am very busy." "I believe the invitation is intended for me alone, my Duke." Startled, he looked at her. His gray eyes flashed. "But you can't just leave me. What about our child?" "I cannot refuse this invitation, my Duke. Not only is she the Emperor's wife, but Lady Anirul is also a powerful Bene Gesserit. And she is of hidden rank." "You Bene Gesserit always have your own reasons." The sisters had helped Leto in the past, but he had never been able to fathom why. With a scowl, he stared at the unreadable scroll that Jessica held in her slender hands. "Is this summons from the Bene Gesserit, or is it some scheme of Shaddam's? Could this have something to do with my attack on Baikal?" Jessica took his hand. "I have no answers for your questions, my Duke. I only know that I will miss you terribly." The Duke's throat tightened. Unable to speak, his only response was to pull Jessica into his arms and hold her tightly.